Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Bring a little sunshine indoors with the exciting new arrivals in store or online at harrycurry.com.
0818 715 815.
Hello, good afternoon. You are very welcome to Liveline. Katie Hannan with you until 3 o'clock today. And I want to go over now to Carl. Carl, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. Thanks very much for having me on your show today.
Carl, thank you for joining us. I'm looking at a photograph right now of your beautiful niece, Maeve Gorman. Just tell me a little bit about Maeve first. Is she 2 years old now?
She is two. She turns three on the 7th of September this year. She'll be three. So she was born in 2021. As a perfectly healthy baby, she was just the most beautiful baby that you'd ever see. She has the biggest eyes I've ever seen on any child.
Honestly, she's just the most arresting look. She's absolutely gorgeous. Yeah. And as you say, there was obviously just a huge excitement with the new baby, and no issues at all, or no sense that there was anything wrong.
Absolutely none whatsoever. She was the type of child that just exuded love, like squeals of excitement when she saw somebody or somebody went over to play with her. She was just so happy. I never heard her cry.
Yeah.
I mean, every baby cries, but Maeve never cried. And we didn't think that was strange. And I still don't think that was strange. She was just such a happy little baby. I wish I could paint a picture of her with my words, but I would never do her justice. She was the embodiment of love. She loved everybody. All she wanted to do was to make everybody happy. So no matter what was in her hand, whether it was a piece of food or a toy, she wanted to give it to whoever was sitting closest to her. She was just the most generous little soul that you could imagine.
So what age was she then, Carl, when you first started to have an inkling there might be something wrong?
So Maeve's mum is Brazilian. So they are growing up, Maeve and her older sister Tina. Tina is four. They're growing up in a bilingual family. So children who are reared in bilingual families, they generally speak a little bit later. So Maeve wasn't speaking. She was making lots of sounds. She was saying words, but at 18 months, they expect them to have 20 words. And Maeve certainly didn't have that. The other issue we saw was she was not walking. And she kind of, her foot had started to turn under. So we thought that perhaps she needed calipers. Now, at that stage, she went to see a physio, and the physiotherapist said to her, "I'll have her walking this time next year." And we were so relieved to hear that. So then she went to see a doctor. So Maeve lives in Ballinasloe. So she went to a doctor in Galway. And that doctor referred her to Temple Street Hospital. And on the 23rd of October last year, they took some bloods. And on the 6th of November 2023, they diagnosed her with a condition called MLD. It's metachromatic leukodystrophy. I'm not even going to attempt to pronounce it here live on air, but if anybody wants to look it up, it is MLD, and it is terminal.
And I cannot begin to imagine the trauma of getting that news and what that did to your family and to Maeve's mum and dad.
Yeah, so they called in to us. They had to drive back from Temple Street to Galway that night, and they actually called in to us. And I've never seen two people so broken. However, the journey since then has been the most devastating thing, most traumatic situation. Like, I cannot imagine how Maeve or how Veronica and John get up every day and continue with life. I'm her auntie, and I'm devastated to watch her slip away. I am in awe of the strength that they are finding to contend with this. So in November, Maeve was still crawling around. She was still learning new words. She was still playing games. She'd be singing songs. She was eating nonstop. I've never seen a child eat as much. She was a tiny little thing, but she ate nonstop. She'd eat my dinner. She'd eat your dinner. She'd eat anybody's dinner who was around. She never stopped eating. And to see her now, less than 8 months later, and she's lying in a bed, and there's just no life left in her. She's paralyzed from the neck down. She's on really heavy duty medication. I don't think she certainly doesn't recognize me anymore. And I don't know how much of the world she takes in that's around her anymore. And that's in the space of 8 months from being able to pull herself up to cruise around furniture to now be lying in a bed where her parents are told they have to lift her so she doesn't get bed sores. And then when they do lift her, sorry, go ahead, Katie.
It's just
devastating.
Such a devastating story, isn't it? It's very hard to imagine. And of course, they have another child to think
they
about
have,
in the middle
yeah.
of this.
Yeah, so Tina is 4, and they talk about children being resilient, but I heard a really good phrase recently, and it's like there's no such thing as a resilient child, just a troubled adult. And I really am concerned about Tina, because her whole life now is watching her sister die, visiting her in hospital, not knowing if when she wakes up in the morning if her mom's going to be there or her mom's going to be in the hospital with Maeve, like who's going to be at home with her, are they going to be staying in Dublin? Like Tina's world has been turned upside down. And I think it's very easy for us to, not for us as the family, but for the general public to forget that the other little people in the lives of these terminally ill children, they sometimes get forgotten with everything else that's going on. And I just really want to highlight the fact that Tina is 4. Other families who've had terminally ill children, they'll understand what I'm talking about. It is a big trauma for children to watch a sibling die.
And for aunts and uncles and everybody in the wider family, the ripple effect just impacts so many lives. The thing is, though, and this is why you're talking to me, Carl, there is a treatment for MLD.
There is, yeah. So both parents have to carry a gene for MLD, and there's a 25% chance that the child will have it. So initially, if the first child born has MLD, they will test the second child at birth. What we really want to happen is we want to have this test included in all the newborn blood spot screening. So for every child in Ireland to be tested for this when they're born.
Because, just to be very clear about this, There is a treatment, but you need to start administering the treatment before the symptoms show. So unless there is a screening or as close to birth as possible. So the fact that some children are being treated with this and very successfully being treated with this right now, but it is only because they had older siblings
who were sacrificed, who didn't
make it because there was no screening for them.
Yeah. In Italy, they're very good in Italy. So this is included in their newborn blood screening over there. Yeah, so they catch it at the start. Yeah.
Just to say, people will be very familiar with the heel prick test that everyone is asked for permission to have this heel prick test done on their baby. Before they're, I think, 5 days old is when this heel prick test. It's just a little prick of blood that is then taken and analysed and screened for. I think at the moment it is, there was 9, and I think there is 2 more being added to it, to the list of conditions that are screened from that heel prick test.
Yeah.
But MLD isn't one of them.
MLD isn't one of them. So statistically, since Maeve has been born, there are 4 more children in Ireland with MLD. Their parents are probably not aware of it. So there could also be children who are older that aren't displaying symptoms. So Maeve has the late infantile variety of it. So it's all the same disease, but it just turns up at different points in your life. So there is a juvenile, which hits them after the age of 5. And then there's an adult one that hits them after the age of 15. So there's technically children walking around with MLD that aren't displaying any kind of symptoms at the moment, that they may not display symptoms until they're over the age of 15. So the younger you are when you get it, the more aggressive it is. So when Maeve was diagnosed, we were told that we could have 3 years. But the way it has progressed so aggressively, we are hoping that we have a full year. It is there's just no making sense of the disease. So although they can theorize that, you know, perhaps you'll have 3 years, Maeve has just deteriorated so quickly. I was staying with them in June, and my brother had texted into the group saying Maeve's gone into hospital, she has another chest infection. And I said, I'll come down and stay with you tonight. That night, she deteriorated so rapidly that the anaesthetist in Port Uncle Hospital had to intervene. And full credit where it's due, he absolutely saved her life that night. He gave her the time to get up to the ICU in Temple Street. That was the most traumatic experience I've ever had in my entire life. I don't know how Veronica and John do this all of the time. There was 10 medical bodies standing around this teeny tiny 2-year-old baby in an ICU bed in Port Uncle to transfer her up to Dublin to save her life.
I know that, you know, you are all in the process of saying goodbye to Maeve, and you know your time is short with her. But you and Maeve's family want something positive to come from from Maeve. That Maeve will be remembered for something, you know, her short life will have meant something.
Yeah, so like we did set up a GoFundMe, and obviously initially we were looking for like funds for certain things. But to be honest with you, our only concern at this stage is campaigning that people are aware of MLD. I certainly hadn't heard of it before November 2023. And I'd imagine most of your listenership will never have heard of it before. It is such a rare disease, but it is devastating. It steals the child from in front of you, like bit by bit. They wake up one day and they just can't do anything. I witnessed the day that Maeve could no longer turn over. We were away in Mayo at Christmas time, and she actually could no longer turn over, and she's never been able to turn over since then. So bit by bit, and I remember the surgeon or the doctor saying to us at the time, what you see on the outside is actually happening on the inside too. So what she's losing on the outside that you can physically see, on the inside, those cells are dying. Those connections in her brain will never be made again. It's the most devastating disease I have ever seen in my entire life.
It's just, yeah, watching markers in reverse. It's just devastating. And of course, there has been campaigning around this. I'll just give people an idea of what's being said around it, because Health Minister Stephen Donnelly, he was asked about this in January in relation to another very tragic case. He announced that that treatment had been approved. That was when that treatment, Libmeld-D, was approved after Ireland engaged in negotiating for a lower price. Because obviously, you know, it's terrible, but when we talk about these conditions and the treatments, money does actually come into it to some degree. He also said at that stage that he had written to the screening committee, and this is the National Screening Advisory Committee. They're the body that advise the minister and the HSE on what screening should be done. He said that he had written to the screening committee, which oversees the conditions included in the heel prick test, and he said it's essential the treatment is given when it is most effective. And of course, as you have very clearly explained there, the time you need to give this treatment is before symptoms show up, and obviously you need the diagnosis as early as possible. Now, we did get a response just before the programme. It just literally was handed to me a moment ago, Carl. So if you'll bear with me, it's from the Department of Health, and it says that the expansion of the National Newborn Blood Spot Screening Programme, that's obviously the heel prick test, that it is that it continues to remain a priority for the Minister for Health and for the National Screening Advisory Programme. It said that Ireland has always evaluated the case for commencing a national screening programme against internationally accepted criteria. They say the evidence bar for commencing a screening programme should and must remain high. It ensures we can be confident that the programme is effective. It says then that in January 2024, Minister Donnelly wrote to the screening committee. That's the quote that I mentioned there. It says that The screening committee confirmed that it will consider this factor in its prioritisation of proposals for screening of newborn conditions. So that's what we're saying, that the developments in the treatment of MLD will be considered now in how it prioritises its proposals for screening these conditions. And it says, however, I must put this in as well, nevertheless, it is necessary to highlight that there is currently no commercially validated test for MLD, which would enable the rollout of a population-based screening programme for the condition. So they're saying, it seems from that, Carl, that they're saying that there is still an issue in terms of a commercially validated test for this condition that could underpin a rollout of a screening programme.
Well, the fact that they use the word consider as well, I'm delighted to know that they are considering it, but I don't think it should be a consideration at this point. I mean, how many children are going to have to die with MLD before they actually just implement it? And if they're talking about commercial, like, how can they put a price on anybody's life? And like, they have a reduced, so I know like Glimeldi is the most expensive drug in the world as well, but they did get a reduction on that. And if the MLD is caught early enough, those children will eventually be part of society and contributing to society. Now, I'm not going to take away from the fact that I just don't believe we can put a price on anybody, child, baby, adult. I am relieved to hear that they are considering it, but I feel it should be more than a consideration at this point.
Well, I suppose, and I'm just again getting a chance now to look back. It's quite a long statement. I'm just looking at some of the other details. They are pointing out that two new conditions have been added to that. That's what I was saying at the top, that there was nine conditions tested. And these are all fairly rare conditions, but as you say, they're conditions that there is treatment for if they're caught early. And they've added two more. So that brings up the number of tests to 11. So they're saying this is a big increase in terms of that. Yeah. So they are, it's good. I suppose the positive part we'll take from this is that.
So absolutely, yeah. Katie, I 100% agree with you. But those two conditions that they have included have not actually been included in the heel prick test as of yet. We're in July. So the funding was made available in February of this year and they still aren't included in the heel prick test, and we're in July of 2024.
Yes, as you say, it's saying here that the two new that was endorsed, once both have been introduced, so they're not actually still, those bloods are not being tested for those yet.
So I know I sound pedantic, but and I'm not criticising anybody in any way, but I just feel that that needs to be highlighted, that they have said that they're going to include them, but they're not yet included in those heel prick tests. Sorry.
No, it's absolutely, and you're absolutely right, because as you say, for every baby born, that could be an important day. They're saying here that the screening committee is conscious of the constantly changing landscape regarding screening, and they say they hold regular calls for submissions from the public, from stakeholders and all of that. The most recent one closed in March 2024. But as you say, you are day in, day out, and your brother, John, and Maeve's mom,
Veronica, they're
looking at Maeve and looking at what happens when you don't get screened, you don't get caught, and it's just devastating.
It is honestly the most devastating thing, I believe, that will ever happen to our family. And I say that with confidence. I mean, growing old is a privilege, and Maeve is just not going to have that privilege. And her parents are never going to get over this. It's unnatural that a parent has to have a conversation around end of life about a two-year-old and then ultimately have to bury their child. It's just not the way the world is meant to work. And she could have been saved.
And as you say, you want this horrific thing that happened to your family to help.
Not
to happen to other family, to for Maeve's memory to be the extension of this heel prick test to include MLD.
Yeah. her little legacy.
I wish you the very, very best, and to Veronica and John and all of your family, Carl. There's nothing more. It's hard to know what to say to you, because there's nothing that'll make the day better for you. But hopefully we'll put that out there and it will be heard by the right ears, and there will be a legacy for Maeve.
Katie, can I just thank you for giving us a platform to talk about this? Like, we are... Our ultimate goal is just to highlight this in society. And I am so grateful to you and your team for giving us the airtime today. And I know that John is speaking to them earlier. They are very grateful as well. So just to let you know that we are very appreciative of your time today and for your listeners listening in as well.
Thank you, Carl. Thank you. And our thoughts are with you all. Take care of yourself.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Now on Liveline, we've been talking to people about different sporting achievements going back in their family history. And we spotted a story about a Drogheda man who describes himself as the only dwarf powerlifter in Ireland. Tommy McKay, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Katie. Thank you for having me on the show.
Oh, Tommy, I'm delighted. I'm delighted to talk to you. You've got such a story to tell. Maybe we just go back to the beginning. Where are you from originally?
I'm from Drogheda, County Louth. Mm-hmm. Been there, born and bred all my life, and still there to this day.
Take me back 12 years, 12 or 13 years, and you were not in a good space, Tommy.
No, I suppose most of my, having dwarfism, it's very easily, you can put on body weight. And so I was kind of always battling, in a sense, obesity. But in 2007, I was made redundant from my job. And I thought I'd be back in employment very quickly, and it didn't happen. There was just no way of hiring. And I found myself just piling on weight very quickly. And it kind of just threw me into a bit of a rut. My confidence, everything was just down. And just then the recession hit, and so there was no jobs, no nothing. And it got to a stage where I thought basically life was comfortable for me. That it didn't matter, you put on weight, you lose it. And my body was letting me know, there were signs telling me, listen, you need to do something. And I kept ignoring them. So I was actually in a friend of mine, John's house. We had drinks on a Friday night, and there was a few lads there, and we stayed over. And the next day, I went to a local centre with my friend Joe. And it was only about 2 minutes away, and we went in there. And I still remember the order to this day, which is crazy. I got a chicken fillet roll, a Lucozade Sport for the athlete, and jam tarts. And I remember walking back. But in the process of walking back to the house, now again, it was only 2 minutes away, I kind of like, you know, I started getting really, really breathless. And I'd like to say it was a hangover, but it wasn't. I had to lie up against the wall. And it was actually a fuse box I was leaning up against. And I was just like really trying to catch my breath. And Joe was just looking at me. And he said, I need to tell you this as your friend. And he does pay home. He said, you're going to die if you don't do something, man. It's like, I don't want to see this happen to you. You have to go on a diet, or you have to get into the gym. And I was like, I know. But I said, it's so hard to get there. And he says, even just do it for a month. And I just basically said, a month. You know how long a month is. And he says, you need to do something, Tommy. So the following Wednesday then, I actually went to Aura Gym in Drogheda. And I kind of just went in there.
Just before you get there, was that hard to hear?
It was, because sometimes your best of friends will tell you the truth. They don't want to hurt your feelings, but it's kind of like, it was hard to hear, but it was probably what I needed to hear. And that was the thing. Like, I never held any malice towards it. I've always thanked them to this day. Like, we joke with each other about that friend that tells you the truth, and they always say, you're welcome. I think it was the best thing that could have been said for me.
Yeah. And so it got you into the gym?
It got me into the gym. I went into Aura, as I said, in Drogheda the following Wednesday. no clue what I was doing, thinking I was grey. I was in there for 2 hours and I left and I couldn't lift my arms. They were actually in really bad pain. And I said, right, go in on Friday. Friday was really painful. So I said, whatever you do, go in Monday. So I took a few days off. And so I went back on Monday and I just gradually just went into it then. And I just done like an hour's training and Monday, Wednesday and Friday. And as time went on then, I increased the hours as well. And I changed my diet up completely. I just knocked out all sugar, like breads, everything. I just went really cold turkey on everything. And then in the base of 10 months, I lost 5 stone.
Wow, in 10 months?
Yeah.
Tell me, it was your friend that actually, it was those words from your friend that actually kick-started this massive like turnaround in your approach to life. Were your family worried about you at that stage?
They would have been, yeah. I'd say, I suppose in the sense of like, you know, because at the time as well, when I wasn't working, it was like you were asleep all day, awake all night. And because you'd no motivation to get out and you'd no motivation to get up in the days. And so you were just up all night, either watching TV or playing PlayStation and stuff. And so they were worried about saying, you need to go out and, you know, go out, get fresh air, or go out or do this, that and the other. And I suppose in a sense, I was choosing to ignore it at the time, you know. It was like, cop on, I'll be fine, you know, that kind of way.
And was your condition, was the fact that you were, you know, that you were a dwarf? Am I okay? Just make sure I'm saying, I'm using the right language here. What language should I be using around dwarfism?
No, dwarf is fine.
Is that fine, yeah?
No, that's fine, that's fine. Little people, dwarf, it's fine with me. It's all acceptable. That's okay. That's no worries at all.
Was that complicating your search for work? Or, I mean, I'm just wondering what it's like to be a little person in a big world.
For myself, then, like my own mother has actually dwarfism, and so does my sister. We got from my mom. My dad, I always say, he's like Michael D. Higgins. Just think of that. And I always say, like, I got the best of both of you. Basically, it's a sense that we had a great upbringing. Like, our mom and dad, they'd always encourage us to go out and chase things and try and be the best in ourselves, you know, and that never try and not let it stop you. So, like, I'm a qualified graphic designer, but I actually, believe it or not, I wanted to be a mechanic. And I actually studied mechanics, but when it came to getting into the engine and all that, I realized, like, my height is against me here. And for safety reasons, you knew it probably wouldn't be feasible. So I went into kind of like graphics, where you can sit at a desk and stuff. So it can be hard in terms of different career paths you might want, where a lot of it will be office based because it's nothing mad physical.
Yeah.
But I did get to do work. My father worked in agriculture, in labouring and stuff out in like Drummonds. I think it's on the gold crop now. So he used to get me sometimes summer work there. So I was in there helping around, looking like heavy bikes, so grass seed and all this kind of stuff. So I always just got stuck in, you know. But there can be an element of your height can limit you to who's going to hire you as well, you know. And you don't want to be judged as soon as you walk in just based on your height, based on the performance, I'd say, you know.
Yeah. When you did then get into the gym, you really got into the gym, didn't you?
I did. I did. I got way too into it, but which I loved. I mean, the element of how I was at the start to how I even am now, like, what, 13 years later? But in the space of the 10 months, you meet a network of people that is there for the same reason. They're all trying to be the best for themselves. And they're always going to encourage everyone. So the network of people I had around me was amazing. It really, really was. And then it was just like, I'm going to the gym. And if you missed it now, your body was going, come on, we got to go. Because it's craving a workout now. And so I was just, for the first time in a long time, being able to fit into a medium T-shirt. And it's like, this is class. This is brilliant. And I just basically I just kept going, and I didn't want to stop with it. And I don't intend ever stopping training, but But it's definitely changed everything for me, and I never thought the path it takes me down that it is now, you know.
And tell me about that path then, because powerlifting became your thing.
It did. So every year in Ireland, it's mainly down in the Hudson Bay Hotel in Athlone, is a convention called Little People of Ireland, and it's run by a couple, Chris and Kat Bork. One of our daughters, I think their daughter, Sinead Bork.
People will know Sinead Bork, very high profile.
Her parents are the original discoverers, I should say, of Little People of Ireland. So at this weekend away, they do these workshops and the stuff about maybe medical things or stuff for adjustments for cars and that. So in 2011, there was actually a couple there, Bernie and Jason Turner, and they actually have a famous daughter as well, who's in the Paralympics at the minute, Nicole Turner. Mm-hmm. People might know Nicole.
Yeah, indeed.
But she does a swimming. So in 2011, they done a workshop saying that in 2013 will be the World Dwarf Games, and they will be held in East Lansing in Michigan, USA. And it's every 4 years that these games are held. So it's the equivalent of basically the Olympics for people with dwarfism. And they wanted to put an Irish team together. So they were kind of looking around the room and they says, Tommy, you know, like with the newfound like fitness regime, would you like to join the team? And I said, I'm not interested in track and field. I want to start doing lifting weights and bodybuilding. And they said, well, there is powerlifting. And I said, well, what's that? And then I saw all these heavy weights being lifted, and I said, I'd like to look at that. So it was testing the body to the extremities. And so actually I said, look, I think about it. So about a year went by, and I was listening to Jim Potram about doing a bit of like kind of bodybuilding kind of thing. And then the following year, he said he interested. And I says, yeah. I says, I'll go for that. Why not? Give it a go. And I started training then about 8 months out for the competition in America. So I started in January and trained right up until that comp. The whole training thing was totally different than what I was used to, because it was like you're not lifting the weights as quick anymore. You're just lifting really heavy weights, but you're only doing a couple of reps and you're sitting there and resting. And I'm like, I'm not really enjoying this. It was like, it's great lifting it, but I'm not feeling that pump. But the experience was something else. And that year, then my first competition then over at the British Dwarf Games, that was on the May bank holiday. And I said I wanted to give that just as a kind of like a little tester to see if I was any good in a sense, or just to get the nerves out of the way, because I'll be honest, I've never done a competition before. You're representing Ireland there in a competition, and it's like, wow. So I went to the British Dwarf Games. I bench pressed 100 kilo. And it was enough to win. And I was like, wow, okay, I like this. And then in August, then we went to the Dwarf Games in America. And I just competed in powerlifting alone. And I came fourth in the category there. So I did.
So your first two competitions, you won?
Yeah.
And you've competed since again then in the Canadian Games and the German Games?
Yeah, so 4 years later, it was in 2017. It was in Guelph in Canada. So I said I was definitely going to go back, try and retain the title. And then obviously COVID hit. So there was nothing for 6 years. So then in 2023, I was contemplating whether doing it or not. And I said, I'll go for a hat trick and see what happens, maybe, you know, that kind of way.
And when you look back now, you know, over the last 13 years, and how from that conversation with your friend in front of Centra or beside up the road from Centra, does it strike you that it was a sliding doors moment? You know?
Yeah. Oh, it's like, I always, everything happens for a reason. And I remember, as I said, I always battled the obesity part. And I remember saying to my brother-in-law one day, and this was before I was at the gym, and we were in the pub and there was wrestling on the telly, and there was one of the wrestlers there, John Cena, I think it was, and he was buff as hell. And I said, I want to look like that one day, and we just laughed. But I think it was a sense I wanted to change just my just everything about me, in a sense. And I thought that the moment would never come, but it was just from that. I think it was the conversation he told me, but I think it was how I was feeling in that moment. If he had said, "You'd be all right there, catch your breath, you know, right, we'll go." But the fact that he told me what was needed to be said, I think that was the wake up. And then it just kind of propelled him.
And would it be fair to say that obviously you physically, you transformed yourself, but psychologically, that was the big change?
Oh, 100%, massively. Even to this day now, I always say, if you're ever feeling this down, I'm not saying the gym is a cure for depression or any of these different things, but it can definitely help with mental health or mental strength in areas. And for me, where I lacked some confidence in different things, it just heightened it for me, no pun intended. But sometimes when you're walking down the street, it can be very daunting walking down the street as a little person in anywhere, fitness or not. But it can be daunting just walking down the street because, you're worried about how the public might perceive you. And I always said, and it still happens to this day, I always said, you'd be amazed the amount of people that need to check the time on the phone when I'm walking past them. You know, it's like, oh, the phone comes out, I'm checking the time. You don't know if a picture's been taken.
You think they're taking pictures or they don't want to catch
your eye? No. You don't know what it's about. What I'm saying is, it can be very daunting just for people walking in the street. So I would have had that when I had the weight on. But when going to the gym and an element of how I felt after it, that I didn't feel that going down the street. The confidence it gave me just to walk down the street, and I didn't care if anybody doing that, you know, that kind of way, where before it was like, oh God, I'd be going down if someone does this and someone looking, or there was things like that.
For people out there listening, Tommy, that might struggle with motivation, that, you know, everyone wants to change for the better, I suppose. You know, everyone has had that moment, and I wish I was that person, that ripped person, that highly motivated, committed person. What is the main tip you would give people to maintain motivation and make the kind of changes you managed to make in your life?
Set goals, definitely, and it's not going to happen overnight. Just allow the process to take time. Surround yourself with positive people. Definitely surround yourself with positive people, because if anyone is negative, there's a sense that they can kind of hold you back. And I'm not saying you have to eliminate them, but it's that thing, ignore the naysayers, as Arnold Schwarzenegger once said. It's just definitely have a good network of people around you. But set a goal and do it slowly. It doesn't happen overnight. But the main thing is to keep moving forward no matter what. There's going to be ups and downs, but the main thing is to pick yourself up, push yourself down and keep moving.
You are the... there's a movie about all of this, a film which is having its world premiere at the Galway Film Fla on July 10th. Laoc, Defy the Odds. It's a great documentary, and it basically follows your whole story all the way to those World Dwarf Games in 2023. And I believe you also stood in Game of Thrones, I should say.
What year was that now? I think that was 2010. I think it was season one of Game of Thrones. I got called to see what I'd be... I actually done a film called Your Highness, and there's one of the extras on it. And I'm always that kind of, if I was on films and that, I'd be always networking. I'd be like, who can I meet? Hello, how's it going? Annie Walker, etc. And I remember they actually said they were filming Game of Thrones in Belfast. And he said, look, we're looking for someone to do stand-in and double for Peter Dinklage. And so I said, oh, yeah, I'm available. No bothers. So that was like 5 months' walk shooting up in Belfast. So
that's one to tell the grandchildren for sure and certain.
Listen,
Tommy, well done. Well done with the movie and well done with everything. It's a great, great story, and great to hear from it.
Anna, thank you. And as I say, it is premiering next week at the Galway Fla Festival. Wednesday, July 10th at 3 p.m. in the Palace Cinema. But I'm just proud of, for my, above all else, for my parents to see it, and my family and partner and that. But I do. I don't know if you've seen it, but it's a sense that
I've just seen a little. I have seen a little of it. I haven't watched the whole thing. I'm looking forward to seeing the whole thing.
But it's a film that, as I said, you see everything. But you laugh, you'll cry. But there's elements where I would just love it to be a film that will inspire people in some way. You know, it doesn't have to be loads. Even if it's two or three people, if it can inspire them to go out and chase their goals and not allow anything to hold them back, then I feel like I'm doing something right in life, and I'm giving something back, you know?
Absolutely, Tommy. Thank you so much, and fair play. Take care of yourself.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815. Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And again, we're talking about sporting, great sporting achievements. And this week we turned in a sideways to a call. We started talking about handball, and one of our listeners' dads was a big handball champion. I want to bring in Pat now. Pat, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
You're passionate about handball, Pat.
Yeah, a little bit. All right, yeah.
Talk to me about that, because a lot of people will say handball. I haven't heard about that. You know, explain, first of all, explain what it is to people that mightn't have come across it.
Okay, handball. So I suppose we play four different codes of handball in Ireland. So we have the traditional 60 by 30, which is the Irish game going back 300 or 400 years. You have the American type, which is a 40 by 20 court, which is also very, very big in Ireland. You have hardball, which is played with a small version of a sitter. Mm-hmm. And then that's what the more popular one at the moment is, one wall court handball. So the one wall court handball is what it is. You have a front ball. Front ball is basically 16 foot high, 20 foot wide. And all the game is to hit the ball off that wall and keep the rally going. So it's played mostly with the open end. Mostly played in singles or doubles. And you play a game up to 21.
Pat, yeah, we're struggling a little bit with your line, but it might be clearing up a little bit there. So we'll struggle on with it for a minute. Why did it drop off? Why did it become the GAA sport that sort of dropped down the you know, in terms of national consciousness?
I think one of the main problems is when handball went indoors. About 40 years ago, we started calling in courts. So where every village would have had a court in the vicinity.
Do you know what, Pat? That line is just, I'm just afraid you're saying really interesting things, and we're not going to hear all of it. So will you hang on? We'll try and fix up the line, and I'll come back to you in a moment. We'll see if we can do better with that phone line, because it's a shame. I really, really want to hear about it. As I was saying earlier on the week, all those handball courts, alleys up and down the country, I would love to hear more about them. In the meantime, I'll bring in Denise. Denise, good afternoon.
Hi, Katie. How are you?
Yeah, Denise, we were talking yesterday about the Wild Roots Festival and how let down people were when it was cancelled just a week before it was due to happen this year on the June bank holiday weekend. You were particularly upset by that news, Denise.
Well, yeah, look, it was unfortunately, like you said, a week before the event was to take place, emails went out with the tagline, "It's with a heavy heart." But I tell you, there was a lot of adults in the country who had heavy hearts that same day. Myself, my husband were to go, one of my best friends, and three other couples that we had met, believe it or not, at Wild Roots 2 years previous.
So you had a little gang going, basically.
We did. We had nine of us from four counties that we were, it was going to be our big summer celebration, and off to Sligo we had all planned to go.
I believe
so evening we got.
Sorry, Denise, sorry, but I believe you actually call yourself.
Oh, the original Wildlings. Yes, we do indeed. Myself and my friends, we'd be good for attending festivals around the country. And in back in 2020, we seen this new festival in Sligo. And we said we'd give it a go, see what the story was. And of course, with the restrictions of the time, it was cancelled, postponed to the following year. And the same happened again. So the first year that we actually got going was 2022 with our original 2020 tickets, if you get me.
Yeah.
So we had an amazing time. We had a great time. We met up with loads of other people from around the country and stayed in contact with some. Met them the following year. Our little party of four met another group the following year, and that party grew to nine, and we were meeting up on the June bank holiday weekend, which never wasn't to be, unfortunately.
And it was, as you say, you obviously loved this festival.
Loved it. Loved it. It was brilliant. It had, like, we're all in our 40s and 50s, and it had something to suit us, but at the same time, during the day, it was quite child-friendly as well. It had activities for much younger children. And we loved it. Like, the lineup was really good. The only staff security that we were meeting in and out of different spaces was really good, really friendly. And the actual layout of the festival, the vendors, between food and bars and people selling all sorts of taste and tasks, it was brilliant. And the lineup itself was really good. We had Rudimental one year. We had Jenny Green another year. We had the Blizzards played at it. There was really good talent. And then you had, aside from that, then you had smaller little stages where local talent, like bands from Sligo and around the country who wouldn't have made it big enough to make main stages as yet, got the opportunity to entertain as well. So it was actually a very well organised from our point of view. And like I said, we've gone to a good few festivals around the country and we thought, yeah, it's a smaller festival, but it was a good one. Hence, we had nine of us going and for the bank holiday just gone.
Okay, so you were, as I say, heavily invested, and then you got that...
we got that email. Yeah.
And again, just to remind people, if they didn't hear us talking about this yesterday, what was in that email was huge apologies that the festival wasn't going ahead and a promise that they would be in touch and that the refunds would start being issued from the 22nd of June.
Correct. And there was, I've two campervan passes and two tickets, which is a little over €400, and it would be fantastic to get that back. But there's not a single word from Wild Roots, from anybody in it at all, which is very disheartening. And they had been very live online beforehand. Like, the month of May, they ran a thing for 2 weeks where you could bring a friend for free. But because I had bought my tickets the previous June, I wasn't sure if that applied to me or if it applied to just people who were buying their tickets in May. So I emailed, and within 2 hours got an email back saying that absolutely it applied, and I got the offer and was bringing yet another friend. There was other things that I had emailed about and got responses really quickly. Anything online, as in socials, a like, a comment, they were very, very active on all social media. And then when this happened, then it was loads of comments, of course, on Facebook, how devastated people were about the event. But everybody took it that, you know, come the 22nd of June, we'd hear something. But there has been absolutely nothing on any of their socials, any of their emails. I've sent a couple of emails myself and a couple of different direct messages just to find out, well, what happened or what is happening. And there has been nothing. And that has been quite frustrating, as you can imagine.
Well, more than frustrating. I mean, you're down, we said nine of you were going to go. So how much money altogether?
I don't know. But I know mine personally was £420.
Right.
Was me. And then the other couples, like I say, sure. Probably, I'd say every couple would be in around the 400 mark anyway.
Yeah. Denise, hang on. I've got David on the other line. David, good afternoon.
Hey, good afternoon. How are things?
You were going as well, David.
Yeah. Just to echo the previous call there, I think we're all in the same boat here. And we'd gone. We weren't an original wilding, as she said. We went for the first time last year. But it was a brilliant festival. It was really, really good. Like, everyone had a great time. It was really well organised, like she was saying. So we said we'd go again. I went with my partner. We booked two tickets for this year. Same as everybody else. Really looking forward to it. It was quite late notice. We got an email saying that it's cancelled, but, you know, these things happen. And we kind of felt the post was put up on the media and the email that was sent to us was quite sentimental. So we kind of felt sorry for the organisers, to be honest, because they did put on such a great festival. So we really appreciated the Wild Roots festival itself. So we were thinking, oh, God love them, they clearly didn't want to do this and it must be so hard for them. So we're quite sympathetic. And it mentioned that a refund would be on June 22nd. So we just said, we'll hold off. They've probably got so much on their plate, you know, paying vendors and stuff like that. So we didn't bother contacting them when we got the email. I kind of wanted to give them space because, my God, I can only imagine. I know how difficult it must be to run a festival, you know. So we said we'd give them space. But June 22nd happened and nothing at all. And then it's just like a shouting into a void now. So I've dropped them a few emails. See, people have been trying to get in touch with them on social media. It's just like they've vanished off the face of the earth. So I think that's the frustrating thing, is that it's just the silence. Like, even if we got told your refund is coming, but there's another day, you know, it won't be coming until August or it won't be coming to them. At least we'd know. But like, now it's like just vanished into thin air. It's the current situation.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, we've been trying to contact the organisers as well. We're kind of hoping that we will hear from them at some stage. We'd love to have them on and have them explain what is actually going on and if or when you're going to see your money again. But for now, David, thank you for that. And Denise, you're going to have to find another name for yourselves now.
We are, we are. No doubt we'll find another festival starting up somewhere and we'll start all over again. We won't be beaten.
Okay. Denise, thanks for that. Thanks, David. And I hope you hear from those organisers sooner rather than later.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy!
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And I believe we have sorted out Pat's line now. Pat Murphy, are you there with us now?
I am. I'm back again.
Oh, Pat, that's much better. Tell us, why should we all be playing handball?
Okay, I suppose just now, I know going back reading an American journal years ago, it was classed as the best overall sport in the world anyway. For, I suppose, hand-eye coordination, fitness, you get to, I suppose, actively promote both sides of your body, left and right. And it's probably the only game where you have world championships from 11-year-olds up to 80-year-olds. So, I mean, you have people actively playing handball at over 80 years of age.
And as I say, it was a hugely popular sport in Ireland back in the day.
It was massive. And I think it was when handball went indoors. Go back 40 or 50 years ago, most courts were outdoors. They were in the middle of the village. Every passerby knew what handball was. They stopped to watch it. Maybe they fell in to play the game. Whereas then when we went indoors, it was hidden away. So unless you were lucky enough to have a very active coach in the parish, and when we were young, our coach went around from door to door and found the kids to play and brought us in.
That's it. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking now, brilliant photographer Kenneth O'Halloran has produced the most beautiful coffee table book of all of these derelict handball alleys up and down the country. And it's a real testament to the game. I don't know, have you seen it? It's a beautiful book.
I have, yeah.
And they're like shrines to this sport that are, as I say, they're in every parish around the country. Some of them in better condition than others. And some of them have been brought back to life.
Some of them have been. I suppose, I think, I know there's a few up there in the west, even in Mayo. Now, they're very active there now in getting old courts up and running again. They had a couple of them in Waterford, again, trying the same thing. So, yeah, but it is. No, it's great if you can get the older clubs. I suppose just for the sake of the tradition, like those courts were where it all began. That's the real Irish handball.
And you were explaining that there before when we lost you on that poorer line. There's different types of handball. There's the one wall handball and the four. Is it the four or the three wall handball?
The four wall. Yeah, the four wall. Okay, so the one wall is it is what it is. You just play with a front wall, and I suppose that's why it's becoming more popular. In that, any secondary school, any school in the country, even a sports hall, you can go in there and for a very, very small amount of money, you can put up a one wall court. Because all you need is a front wall, mark the lines on the ground, and that's the basics. That's why the one wall is becoming more popular. Then in Ireland, we traditionally play four wall. And there's two forms. The Irish court, which we call the big court, that's 60 foot long and 30 foot wide.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we play, I suppose. That's what's played in the summer months, because most of these courts, they're concrete walls and a big galvanized roof. So very, very near impossible to heat.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the winter time, we'd play, I suppose, the American version, which is a 40 by 20 court. Now, they're indoors, well insulated, nice and warm. That's the American court. So, and there's a good international element in that. Another reason why it's so popular, because a lot of the Irish players travel over and back to America for the pro stops.
Now, you've a good few Ireland titles yourself, have you, Pat?
Well, I picked up my own few along the way. Now, I mean, I got my first when I was under 15, but I waited another 25 years for another one. But like the top level, I play my own grades.
And going back again to the origin of the game, because we would have played it as kids, you know, there was always a handball knocked around the place. But you don't see kids out with it now. But I'm looking here that it goes right back to the 1500s in Ireland.
Oh, it does. No, I mean, you can find articles and even hand drawings there about, especially in boarding schools. There's a lot of boarding schools that still have handball courts in their grounds. They mightn't be used, but they were very, very popular there. A lot of the army barracks had handball courts as well. And even the Garda still had their own All-Ireland Championship every year. So it is widespread, goes back a long time, goes back, Ireland, I suppose, they can almost claim the roots of the four-wall handball.
Right up to today, it is one of the four GAA sports, Gaelic Association sports. But a lot of people mightn't even be aware of that.
No, it is one of those things there now. I suppose it is the hidden branch of the GAA, all right. We're governed by GAA and their rules, but it was never really tied in. No, in my opinion, this is not the official line, but it is a GAA handball sport. We are governed, like even the main handball court, the facilities are in Croke Park themselves.
Yeah, well, of course, that was the subject of quite a lot of controversy over the last while. I covered it myself back in prime time.
That's right.
It was the row over that handball court and what was being suggested to be done with it might have been basically what kicked off the row over the those concerts, and that became quite the story for the GAA for some years.
It did, yeah. look, thankfully, I won't get into it. We got over it. We have a new facility. No.
And it's a beautiful new facility. It's a beautiful new facility, isn't it?
It is. No, they're a fantastic show court. And there's a show court there with seating for 450 people. That's for the 40 by 20 court.
Yeah.
And they have the 3 foot, and they have a big court, the Irish type court as well.
And has that new facility, because it is still relatively new, has that kicked off a renewed interest in it, do you think, Pat?
To be honest, I think it's more the grassroots that are kicking it off. There is, it hasn't done any harm, but at the same time, it wasn't, I think it was happening already anyway. The new centre actually is more appealing because now the senior All-Ireland finals are gone back to Croke Park again. That's the main thing. Like when we grew up, the main goal was to be able to play in Croke Park. You could play your All-Ireland anywhere in the country, but it was to play in Croke Park was the big thing. I suppose we were lucky enough that way. And then for maybe a 10 or 15 year period, it was gone from Croke Park. So that bit of shine was off of your All-Ireland title.
Hang on with me there, Pat. I want to bring in somebody who I think is a friend of yours, actually, Ollie Cassidy. Ollie, good afternoon.
How are you doing?
Yeah, Ollie, you're the voice of handball, are you?
Well, I'm one of the voices. Pat is a big voice of handball too. He's one of the big advocates of the game. But no, we just heard it while I was doing a coaching session there myself in Quinlan Park in one of the outdoor alleys, and we heard you on the radio, so we said we better ring in because that's our life, handball. So you're talking about the old Ellie's, eh?
We were talking about the game in general. I mean, you're one of the commentators for the game,
That's right. Yeah, we'd be up in Croke commentating about the game and all the different people that's playing the game in the All Ireland. And I think Pat just mentioned there the All Ireland was a big day. It was great to get to Croke Park. Croke Park was the ultimate. You could play all around the country, but if you got to Croke Park, you had it made, But there was a big difference between playing in Croke Park and winning in Croke Park. Every time I went to Croke Park, I was like the Mayo football team. I lost.
Right. What was your excuse?
Nerves, right. The crowd, Anton, the short line, the referee. I'd blame Anton. But myself.
Everything but the course. And are young people taking it up now? That's the big question.
More and more young people are playing this game called One Wall. Years ago, as Pat mentioned, it was all 6x30 outdoor courts. And we're trying to do, around Mayo anyway, we're trying to do a few of them up now and get them going again, because it was great in the summer's evening and the sun going down and you'd be flat out playing handball. And it was great. It was great crack, and we'd have a picnic and we'd a flask of tea and you'd be playing away, and there'd be money in the corner too. And there'd be war after the game too. So it was great crack. But more and more people now, that they're leaving down the PlayStation, the young ones. I'm a PE teacher at school and I'm trying to get them to leave down the PlayStation and the phones and get back to motor learning, the hand-eye coordination and everything. And I think Pat is doing the same down there in Broadford.
I'm thinking, if you were good at squash, would you be good at handball in terms of...
You would. But I always say, if God wanted us to play squash, he'd have stronger fingers. Hands, it's all about the hand. The bare hand.
If you're talking about God's gifts, if you're born with big hands, does that make you, that gives you an advantage?
Oh, a big advantage for spinning the ball, catching the ball. That's, now you're talking. Your big hands were equivalent to a baseball or a bat, a table tennis bat. If you had big hands, it was great. Now, look at the loads of people with small hands winning All Ireland, but the older lads I used to see, I'd be shaking their hands and the big, massive hands like a shovel. So they couldn't miss the ball, Katie.
I'm thinking as well, though, the kind of work that you would do, the outdoor work, either turf or hay and all that, and the physical work that you would do and the dexterity you'd need in your hand for that, that would obviously have helped you as well in terms of...
It would, of course, because the left hand, you're using the right side of the brain. That's more for thinking and learning and learning off things. And you're using the left hand side, hitting the ball. And then you're using the right hand side, that's more from memory base and heart. So that you're thinking with the left hand side. So that ambidexterity, there's only one other game that's good for that. And that maybe might be hurling, the GAA hurling. You're using both sides of the body, mm-hmm. And in NASA, the astronauts were putting through a handball program. Pat Kirby from Clare used to put them through a program before they went to space. He was training them handball for this coordination, to learn their coordination.
Seriously, yeah. Astronauts were.
Yeah, Pat Kirby, he was living in America, and he was going to NASA, and he'd do a handball program to get them fit before they went to space.
Because, as you say, if the double side of the brain.
Yeah, both sides of the brain, yeah, and using that ambidexterity. Mike Tyson, the boxer, the world heavyweight champion, his handball coach was Jimmy Jacobs, and he was trying to get the power into both hands. And you saw the destruction he did in the ring, Mike Tyson.
Indeed. Has there ever been a campaign to get it to the Olympics?
That's what they're doing now with this one wall ball. They're trying to, and Pat was probably talking to you earlier about it, but we missed it. They're trying to get that into the Olympics now, and there's more and more European countries going on board. We travel now every year to Valencia in Spain, we go to Belgium, we go to France, we go to Germany, and we go to England, London. We play this game called One Wall, and we're trying to get that into the Olympics at the moment. So it'd be brilliant to get it into the Olympics.
Ollie, will you hang on? I've got Chris Downey on the other line. Chris, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Your uncles were
legends. Yeah, my uncles were pretty good at handball.
Yeah, go on. Tell us who they were and what they did.
Paddy and Dennis Downey. My uncle Paddy was the better of the two. He had 21 All-Irelands himself, both in singles and doubles. And the thing about my uncle Dennis was he was born with a congenital cataract, but he was still phenomenal. In 1959, there was an ex-army champion coming from Dublin who was actually touted here in the local papers as beating my uncle. But He didn't.
And your uncle had a difficulty seeing the ball, but was still beat the fully sighted champion.
Well, he spent hours and hours and hours every day playing. What happened was one Christmas, they just got a handball. And off the gable end of the house, they stayed playing until they were the greatest the country had ever seen.
And I suppose that was it, wasn't it? That you could actually just, all you needed was the gable end of a house and a ball. And off you went.
Dune Alley now, which is, it's actually in neglect at the moment, I suppose, because the game is coming to, not as many kids are playing it now. But that's where they would have spent a lot of their time, which is a local alley to us. My Uncle Paddy was instrumental, actually, in getting the handball alley and squash courts in the Tralee Sports Centre. He did a lot of the fundraising for that.
And do they still play handball down in Tralee, Chris?
Unfortunately, they're both passed away now.
No, but saying, is handball still big play down there?
It's not as big. I mean, there is a little bit, but generally it's the squash, it's the racquetball, that sort of thing. But I do see it coming back a little bit more now with the youth, which is great. Ballymac, which is only out the road from us, would have a big youth programme.
Ballymacallagher. Listen, Chris, I've taken another break. I love hearing these stories so much. I've just been told here, Father John Murphy, obviously of the 1798 rebellion fame, was apparently one of the best handball players of his time and frequently held rebel meetings in the local handball alley. So they were put to more use than for a handball. Chris, thanks for that, Chris. Great stories. Ollie loved that. And Pat, thanks for that. We'll take a break.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
Joe Duffy.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815.
And I only have a minute left, but I want to just go back to you, Pat, if you've stayed with us. Are you still there, Pat?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah, Pat, just before I go, if people wanted to see this game being played, is it televised? Where would we go looking for it?
Okay, just this year now, it's actually on the TG4 player. So anytime the main games are on, TG4 are streaming them live.
And does Ollie do the commentary player for them?
Yeah, he does most of them, yes, yeah.
Any of it on GAA Go, lads?
Not quite there yet.
GAA Go, just
TG
Car.
Right. No,
getting
there.
We've had some calls about GAA Go this week, so it is being covered, and you can see it if you want to go to it. And I think if people did see it, because it is a very exciting game.
It is. No, it's great, and I suppose to see it now, the commentary does help. The commentary can be very exciting.
Yeah.
Thanks to Ollie there. But that half the game, half watching the handball, half listening to Ollie. But no, it is a very quick paced game. And I think to really appreciate it, you need to see it. And like see the top players at their best.
At their best. I've got just very, very quickly, Afra. Are you there, Afra?
I am indeed, yes.
I have literally 15 seconds for you. But
I
wanted to get in. Your uncle, Nicholas Casey, is it?
Yes, he was a parish priest in a place called Cadbegan, County Westmeath. Uh-huh. And he reared me for 7 years, 7 wonderful years, and in which there was a ball alley, by the way, but it's gone now. But he gave me his All-Ireland champion. Well, there were gold and silver. I had about 7 medals that he gave me. And unfortunately, I became very needy when I was 19, on living on my own, and I pawned them to my shame.
Oh.
And it breaks my heart every time I think of it, which, never mind, that's life, isn't it?
They're out there, and he won them.
Apparently he was a wonderful athlete, yes, but a long time ago. I'm 81 now, so you can imagine. It must have been just at the turn of the last century.
Wow. Okay, so we're remembering him today, Nicholas Casey, and his All-Ireland medals.
Nicholas Casey. Afra,
I have to go, Afra. Thanks for that.
Yes, of course you have. Thank you, Casey.
Thank you. And we're over time. Apologies to Ray. On sound today, James Feeney, our broadcast coordinator, Shane Galvin. Today's programme was produced by Shan O'Gorman, and we'll hand you over to Ray.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Summer's here. Spruce up your bedroom for less with our sizzling summer sale offers at harrycurry.com.
Talk to Joe on 0818 715 815 or send your WhatsApp voice notes to 087 484 8888.